This is New Classical Tracks from listener-supported American Public Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, you know what? The best thing that you can do for this show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Cécile Chaminade was really kind of the Taylor Swift of her time. I thought that was an amazing quote from violinist Anna Williams. I talked to her recently, along with her husband, cellist Mikhail Veselov, about their newest recording with the Neve Trio. It's called A Room of Her Own, and it celebrates early works from four women composers. That's what we're going to find out about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. All right, well, first of all, welcome to violinist Anna Williams and cellist Mikhail Veselov. Did I get that right, Misha?
Yes, it's perfect.
Okay, right.
Better than I can do.
Also known as Misha.
Yes.
Where are you? Where are you, the two of you, located right now as we're having this conversation?
Well, right now we are in our kitchen in Richmond, Virginia. Neve Trio is currently ensemble in residence at Virginia Commonwealth University. We might be interrupted by our 7.5-month-old, but like we said before, it'll keep things really authentic. So we're in Richmond right now, and we're just loving it.
Wonderful. And so and that's where you live and where you spend most of your time when you're not on the road, it sounds like.
When we're not on the road, yeah.
Exactly. But we just moved from Boston. So we spent quite a bit of time in Boston as well still. But we're grateful for very mild winter here in Richmond. It's very nice.
It's a lovely surprise.
The last time that we talked was in 2019, and that was right after your release of the recording, Her Voice. And that recording, like your latest, A Room of Her Own, features music of distinguished women composers. Why is that important to you to celebrate women composers?
Well, as a woman, as an ensemble, it's anytime we feel like we can play a small role in shining a light on any underheard voices, we are delighted to play that role, however we can do it. And obviously, women have historically, and still to present day, in many ways have been underheard. All these incredible composers are their own. You know, they really are unlike each other, individual, very authentic and unique voices, all really deserving their own space. And, we're big advocates for all good music. And it doesn't matter the gender, race, background, none of it matters. If it's good music, it's a joy and privilege to get to sort of dive into.
I'm struck by the title, A Room of Her Own, because I'm guessing that it is connected to Virginia Woolf's book, A Room of One's Own. Is that the case?
Yeah. There's actually, the connection is actually Ethel Smyth, one of the pieces in the recording. Ethel Smyth was very much acquainted with Virginia Woolf. There's actually rumors of them having some kind of romantic relationship as well. And Ethel Smyth was also a suffragist, and she was kind of a rebel. She was openly bisexual back in the early 20th century, which is unbelievable that she was so vocal about who she was, and then she actually ended up in jail because she was kind of in the more militant sort of wing of suffragist movement. And she, she composed the March for Women, and she was just quite a character. Besides just being a composer and a wonderful one, of course, she also was just a huge personality and activist and a writer. And, she was involved with a lot of people, including Virginia Woolf.
But I think the title, obviously there is that sort of wink and to Virginia Woolf and her incredible legacy and impact. And then, on a more sort of simplistic level of each of these women really deserve the space. Like they deserve their own room, to put it another way. And like creating that space, creating that room for these voices to be further celebrated, on top of what has happened thus far. So again, playing that small role in being able to do that is something we're really, really privileged to be able to do.
two generations of composers are represented on this recording. How might that be significant?
Well, I think it's probably mostly accidental, but when we were working on the program, you know, we did realize that sort of Smythe and Chaminade are, you know, from middle like late Romantic into sort of more contemporary modernist style, and then obviously Taillefer is very, very modernist and experimental. But it's just an interesting era of that transition, you know, and you can see in Ethel Smythe, even though very Brahmsian kind of writing, and she was from that school, she really experiments with transitions, with melodies, with how she sort of switches things from one to another and how she plays around with the melodies throughout the whole piece. So the same with Chaminade. I mean, she was a beautiful, obviously amazing pianist and beautiful composer, beautiful writer, but she you know, she really pushes the limit into the pianism in her writing. So, and then on the other hand, Taillefer, you know, she truly was a modernist composer, and the piece that we recorded, the trio, she wrote in sort of early 20th century, and then she came back to it in at kind of end of her life when she was in her 80s and changed it around. So it is almost like a late 20th century piece in some way. So just the span of that era, that period, and how much has changed. And Boulanger, obviously, yeah, she was she died. She had a very short life, died at 24, but she made such an impact. And again, her music is so specific. It's really her, unmistakably, you know, how she uses the harmonies, how she uses the form. So I think it's just all of these women, they really made a huge impact on the music we have today, you know, in their writing. So I think that's significance, but it wasn't intentional. I think it's just once you hear the whole album, just realizing that how much music has changed for them.
But it is also, it's so fascinating too, that like it happened, you know, it happens to be a shared time period, and yet I don't think if you were to play Drop the Needle, I don't think you would necessarily guess that at first glance. So it's, again, like they're sort of playing by their own rules. They're sort of breaking the rules in all the best ways, and the individual voices of each artist is really, I think, to Misha's point, I think very striking.
I am curious about that, because one of the things that I read was that all four of the works featured on this recording were written by these women when they were in their early 20s. Now, of course, for Lily Boulanger, she died at 24, so I don't know how significant that is, since she wasn't able to write anything later than that. But how is the fact that for most of these composers, these works were written early in their career, how does that reflect maybe who they did become?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting because in the case of Taillefer, it's not unlike stories that we know of Brahms. It's both an early and a mature work because she, you know, she came back to it and revised it heavily. So what is it, the first and third movements?
The sort of the original ones, yeah. Second and fourth are more mature works, mature movements rather.
Yeah, and so oftentimes when we play this work for an audience, we'll have them sort of guess, which it's a little bit like a time travel, and we, you know, have them guess like, oh, okay, which ones sound, you know, stereotypically youthful, and which do you think are more mature? And 9 times out of 10, the guess is the opposite. So, the youthful works are very, I don't know, how would you say somber or...
I think more sort of significantly, I think the second and fourth movement of Taillefer's trio, they're just so full of energy and humor and kind of wit and stuff. So, you know, her being in her 80s, you just... I imagine her being this very energetic, full of life person, despite quite of an advanced age, you know. And she, I think all of these women, it's kind of to your point that they all wrote in their 20s, and that doesn't include Lily Boulanger, that they have such a distinctive writing and distinctive voice and distinctive qualities in their music, despite being so young. I think that is very striking. And, you know, realizing that it's very early. I know in case of Boulanger, of course, it was also end of her life, unfortunately. But for Smythe and for Taillefer and for Chaminade, they wrote a lot more after that. But they were already such masters at such early age.
I am thinking sort of like in the case of the Boulanger, like there's so much, if you think of the sad evening. Much gravitas there. The harmonies are so dense and, for lack of a better word, heavy. And it doesn't. I don't know. There's something. There's an element of finality that I think. I mean, of course, we're sort of, you know, projecting that from hindsight. But I think there is something so deep in that it doesn't. I'm not sure one would, again, on playing drop the needle. I don't know that one would say that someone in their 20s wrote that. You know, beyond her years. And then with Smythe, I'm thinking, you know, she has so many ideas that sort of in rapid succession. For instance, the fourth movement, I mean, there's so many. It's almost like a quick pan of the camera, you know, like a different shot, one right after the next. So many sort of dramatic ideas that happen so quickly. And I think later on, she sort of, you can kind of hear the seeds of what's to come for her in terms of, you know, developing those ideas further. And yeah, so it's an interesting range, I would say.
I was thinking about Lily Boulanger because the two movements that we hear from her larger work were written a year before she died at age 24. And she had been very sickly throughout her life, so maybe it isn't too surprising that we hear something that's a little more somber.
Yeah, you know,
do you see a connection there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, she was sick since she was two. She had pneumonia very young, and then her immune system got very compromised, so she was constantly ill. And at the time when she was writing these two pieces, she was very, very ill. And essentially, my understanding, there's only one piece that was written after that, and she just dictated that she couldn't even write. Mm. And that piece is Be Jesu, and it's just unbelievable, too. So if you listen to it, just a combination of instruments, it has organ and string quartet and harp and a voice, and it's just out of this world. It's just something completely otherworldly, like for lack of a better word, you know. It's just so I think she had that understanding that those were her last words in some way, and she was looking beyond this world. And I think it's just very profound that she was able to convey that in her music. You know, I think that she kept writing for the last moments.
And she had the support of her sister, Nadia Boulanger, too, it sounds like, who was actually helping to notate some of these works. Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, out of the composers on this album, Lily was the only one who really had a supportive family. Nadia, for sure, you know, of course, she's the incredible pedagogue who taught everyone from, I don't know, Quincy Jones, Piazzolla, like you name them, he studied with her. But she really, in a way, turned her focus to this sort of pedagogical, because she really sort of became a champion for Lily and her writing, and felt like she was sort of the artist in that way. So yeah, we have Nadia to thank a lot for knowing about Lily and her brilliance.
Let's talk more about that, how challenging it was for these women to actually try to do anything in the realm of music. Tell us a little bit more about each of these and their story and how maybe they overcame that struggle, so to speak.
Yeah, well, Taillefer, for example, you know, her actual name was Taillefer, with two S instead of R. So she changed her name just despite her father, actually, you know. And in most of those cases, their fathers were the ones who were not supporting of their study of composition specifically. You know, playing piano, for example, was much more accepted. It was almost like a, you know, not only accepted, but expected thing for women certain class to do. But composition was sort of, oh, no, you don't do that. In Paris Conservatory, for example, you weren't, as women were not allowed to take composition, counterpoint, fugue writing, things like that. So you know, in case of Taillefer, maybe in her time you could already do that, but her father was against her studying at the conservatory.
Didn't she have to make hats to support herself?
Oh, yeah, she was a hat maker as well, yeah, at Taillefer. So, but, you know, same with Ethel Smythe. She was basically disowned by her family. She had to make her own living. You know, she was, it's amazing to not only realize that this music is so incredible, but it was written with all these obstacles that they had to overcome. You know, it wasn't just hard to be a composer, but to really fight for ability to do that.
There really wasn't a path for them to follow.
Yeah.
So to speak, you know, as opposed to their male counterparts who maybe someone would be a protege of someone else. And, you know, there were more opportunities. I mean, unfortunately, this is not a story that is over. You know, there is still definitely certain classes of people that have easier times having their stories heard. But what an incredible sort of addition to their offerings that they overcame what they did.
Noted too about Germaine Taillefer that Eric Satie referred to her as his musical daughter. What was it about her that impressed him?
Well, I think it's her own place that she took in this medium, in the genre of music. You know, she was the only one out of only one female member of Les Six, and they were sort of all kind of, you know, proteges in a way of Satie's. He kind of, the way it started, you know, they put together a concert of music by the six composers, and Satie was advocate for Taillefer to actually be included in that concert. And, you know, reviews came out and they were named Les Six in the papers, and that's sort of how it came about. But even then, you know, Satie was obviously a huge supporter of Taillefer, and, you know, we have to thank him for her to take that place in that group that was quite admired and appreciated. But even within the group and from, you know, sort of public perspective on the group, she was sort of this accessory, and everybody's like, oh, isn't that cute that she's part of it? And she still wasn't taken as seriously as she deserved to be taken, despite being part of this very acknowledged and appreciated group, which again is unbelievable.
It reminds me of the quote, not about Taillefer, but about actually Shami Nad, that you know, one of the positive reviews about her at the time was said, what was it, is this is not a woman composer, but a composer who happens to be a woman. And that was like high praise. So it's telling of the times.
I thought it was interesting about Cécile Chaminade that she started off composing large-scale works like an opera, orchestral music, and then in her 30s she started to focus more on piano miniatures and melodies. Do you know why she made the shift in that direction instead of the other way around, smaller works and then larger works?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about it, but
yeah, our sense of her is in her writing. It's so clearly pianistic. Our pianist would tell you as much, that it's like, yay, it fits in my fingers, and it's, you know, it feels like it's for me, which is so, I would imagine, really, really lovely. As a pianist, it seems like she, you know, was very aware of like creating, not to overuse the phrase, but sort of creating her own path in that, you know, writing, not to sound silly, but kind of like the Taylor Swift of her time, of writing her own material that then she would perform and have her own opportunities to perform, sort of writing her own way. So it seemed to work out pretty well for her. She still has, aren't there still like Chaminade clubs or what would you call it?
Yeah, she was you know, touring pianist, and she toured in the States. And I think that review that Annie mentioned actually came out of that one of those tours in the United States. But there's still an existing, I think, Chaminade club, and I think in New York, actually. So there were actually those clubs all over the world that you just were waiting for Chaminade's music to come out, and if she would perform in the area, they'd all be there. So she had literal fan clubs back in the day. So
it is interesting too that you mentioned the larger scale to smaller scale works, in terms of if you think of her writing, and in this trio as an example, she really does access I would say quite the full range of both, you know, the pianistic abilities, but then the ensemble abilities. Like the slow movement is so, it's very operatic and very sort of intimate at the same time. And then there's also very sort of symphonic writing in her piano parts, very sort of large scale and impressive in that way. So it makes sense in the context of her chamber music writing that she sort of has that in her background, sort of in her imagination at the time.
Of the four composers featured on this recording, three of them are French. Is there any reason for that?
I think it's also coincidental, but you know, I think it's always the hardest part about putting those sort of programs together for the recordings is to choose which ones. You know, and there's so much great repertoire, and I think we started with we played Chaminade Trio for quite a while, and same with Taillefer. Where she played her piece at the Bard Festival for the first time that was dedicated to Nadia Boulanger, because Taillefer was also affected by Nadia Boulanger in some ways. And so it's Lily's piece. But then we discovered Smythe Trio for ourselves, and we're like, oh, we would love to do that one. And so it didn't make any necessarily direct connection, but we just really wanted to record that one along with the other pieces. So
it's an embarrassment of riches.
Exactly.
Playing in a piano trio, because there's so much incredible repertoire from the past and also currently being written. So it's, yeah, sometimes it's just sort of, oh gosh, what sort of feels like it rounds out the experience of the program for the listener in a way that makes sense, you know, in a way that has variety and sort of hits certain points in a certain way, you know, that provides a depth or a variety of experience.
Dame Ethel Smythe was actually acknowledged more for her later larger works throughout her career. This piano trio is one of her earlier works, and it was never performed publicly in her lifetime. Do you know why?
I'm not exactly sure why again, but I think, you know, it was published relatively recently too. It wasn't even published for quite a while. And I, you know, kind of come back to Chaminade, a question as well that you had about sort of larger scale works. I was just studying about Louise Farrand, who's another piece that we recorded in our previous album, you know, that she actually did mostly chamber music and piano music. And because of that, she actually struggled, because the popular genre was opera, and it was, you know, so chamber music was written sort of into the desk often, or to perform with your friends, or perform in salons. In Germany and Vienna, it wasn't the case, but in France, for sure, it was the case. You know, and opera was sort of the higher class kind of composition. And it has changed, obviously, since. And you know, I wonder if Chaminade has the same issues, that she started writing large-scale works because that's what was more in demand, I guess. And I think same with Smythe. You know, she ended up being acknowledged for her operas and large-scale works, but chamber music was kind of second class for some reason, maybe at the time. You know, it wasn't as grandiose as appreciated.
But I do think you can hear the seeds of what's to come in her writing, in her wonderful range of characters that she includes. It could almost veer on, you know, on operatic or almost cinematic in a way. One of the stories that we find so symbolic of her as this character is she spent a little time behind bars because of her work as a suffragist. And during that time, she taught her fellow inmates the anthem that she had written for the movement. And this sort of image that we were presented with is that she taught it to them and then conducted her fellow inmates using a toothbrush. So there's just sort of this snapshot of this woman, determined, quirky, I think you could say, strong, holding high convictions, and then, of course, you know, many, many other sides as well. But I do think you can sort of hear her personality in this youthful work, as well as seeing where she develops.
Well, Ethel Smyth was definitely courageous, and in the second movement, she actually included a note in the score that reads, "The courage of simplicity." What does that mean to you as performers?
That's a great question. Well, that's a variation movement too, which I think is interesting and almost ironic, because the idea is to take simple melody and sort of complicate it in different ways and make it different every time. So I think it's almost... Almost with it, a little bit of a joke in that context, but for sure, I think composer, you know, any writer or composer, I think editing is one of the hardest parts, right? To sort of decide what is there to leave after all the ideas kind of flow. I guess maybe it's something to do with her process a little bit too, having to edit herself a little bit, which she obviously is so full of ideas. And as I said before, it's definitely is no shortage of great tunes and melodies and interesting transitions and harmonies. So I think maybe that's was her exercise in sort of trying to stay simple and just stick to variation form in that case.
In addition, I think, you know, the idea of simplicity really is, it is vulnerable, for lack of a better word. And when you're performing, you know, not hiding behind the sort of... I don't know, the extras or the trappings. I don't know how else to say, but really just trying to bring out the material the best that you can, and sort of bringing your whole self and experience and intuition to that process is, I think, the task. So that then an audience really hopefully takes something away from the experience. But it is a beautiful reminder, and it's a pretty profound one of, you know, the courage that it does take in any walk of life, really, I would say, right? But the idea of to be simple, and I take that as a bit of sort of a call to openness and sort of vulnerability that it takes to show up and really not hide behind too many, you know, whether it's compositional techniques or you know, extraneous things when you're playing. It's a beautiful reminder.
When you perform each of these works, I'm curious, what impacts you the most? Is it the music itself, the composers and their stories, or something else?
That's such a great question, because we talk about it a lot, actually, about like why we do what we do and why does it matter to perform, perform live, especially after pandemic, sort of, you know, allowing us to come back to some live performances. But I think, you know, the biggest thing we try to do is connect to the piece. And sometimes it helps us to have the window through the composer's experience and sort of knowing a little bit, or assuming, I guess, in some cases, a little bit who they are, like in case of Lily Boulanger. I think it is very helpful to know that yes, she was very young, but she was kind of at the death's door already. Mm. And that's just so tragic and profound for a young person to be in that place. Mm. And knowing it, you know, it's not just an accident that she knew that she had very little left. That does kind of put a certain lens on the piece, especially on the slow movement. It does open up a little bit different perspective. You notice a little bit of different things. Mm-hmm. But even if there's not a connected, you know, story or sort of this specific context from a composer's life, I think we still try to connect to something in the music that affect us, and try to hope that at least some people in the audience will have similar experience or their own experience, you know, experience this in their own way and have something to connect to. So definitely the idea of connecting to the music that we play, whether it's through composer's story or from our own perspective on the piece. We always talk about colors and moods and sometimes images and sort of we talk about theory and harmonies and structures and stuff, but what we found the most effective for us is really talk about descriptive words and something that puts us in a state of mind where we can really connect to what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually not related to this set of repertoire, but it just brought to mind how knowing something about the composer can really sort of heighten that feeling of connection. And I was just thinking about when we were working on the Ravel Trio was on our last album. You know, that was an example where I certainly grew up with Ravel Trio as, you know, on a shelf and just such an iconic and sort of untouchable piece, which I'm not advocating for that mindset. I'm just being honest. I was very intimidated by it. And we were working on it really during the height of the pandemic. And one of the things that really stuck out was not so much the sort of, you know, analysis of his brilliance and his writing and the different factors that go into making it so brilliant and, you know, the subject of countless dissertations, I'm sure. But it was that he wrote that trio, I believe it was a matter of weeks. I think it was 5 weeks, if I'm not mistaken. And the reason for it wasn't some arbitrary deadline. It was because he was going to serve in the Great War, in World War I. And, you know, having that experience, especially during the pandemic, when, you know, I'm sure we all remember, we'll never forget, that we really didn't know what the next sort of day or week or month would bring. And the sort of sense of time was fleeting, but also standing still. That kind of connection to the soul of the person who, you know, is so easy to put on a mantle and sort of idolize. But that feeling of, yeah, but we're all muddling through. We're all to a degree or another, we're all having this human experience. And so I do think finding those moments, not that it has to be sort of programmatic or, you know, well, this movement is about this thing that happened in her life or the, you know, but just knowing the individual stories, it really can help to connect to their sort of world, because this is kind of, you know, our version of letters or diaries from them in a way. So I think it's a wonderful thing to know and to also note how much these women, coming back from Ravel, how much these women really did overcome just by virtue of being women in the times in which they lived, and how that adds, I think, to the depth of what they've created.
What did each of you discover about yourselves in putting this project together? And maybe it was something that really surprised you or caught you off guard.
Well, I'll go first. So I actually was pregnant when we were recording this, and it was a little bit of a precarious time during the pregnancy. And I truly didn't, from each take to the next, there was a part of my brain that didn't know if that would be the last take that I, you know, that I might have to seek medical treatment. So it really was, it really made me very present to the beauty and the depth of these works. And I will say that just the happenstance of being pregnant during the time of creating this album, celebrating women, it did shine, I have to say, a further light on, wow, as women, regardless of, you know, if someone chooses to have children or not, but there's so much that we do that we create and I want to say put up with, but that's maybe a negative spin. It gave me such a sort of deeply rooted awe for what these trailblazing women were able to do. And I think I was extra present to that given our life circumstance.
Yeah, I don't know if I can add anything. I know, I'll just second that. I know it's a little bit of a cheating answer, but I want to, you know, it's truly incredible that, again, not because they were, you know, women, they're composers and their music exists as is, as just music, but just being slightly aware of that they mm-hmm. all had these very complicated lives just by virtue of who they were, not mm-hmm. because of their choices or that anything, you know, they've done. And, mm-hmm. and yet they were able to create this beauty and it still lives on today, and then we get to play this music, and you know, it's pretty special. And I think it applies to all the music that we play. But these four pieces, you know, we got to know them in this process of preparing for this recording, and you know, we hope to that the other Chaminade trios. There's mm-hmm. a lot of great music that, you know, is underplayed and needs to be played more. And you know, I hope we get to do more of this soon, and I hope other people who hopefully will either remind themselves about these composers or discover them for this recording, we'll listen more, perform more, and study works by these composers and others.
The recording is A Room of Her Own with the Neve Trio. Thanks to Valerie Kaler. She's our producer for New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher.